Today's session is called Cyprus, Mount Olympus, the highest mountain on Cyprus, Much Invaded Island. And I'd like you to deal with Cyprus from the point of view of that question of invasions. There have been apparently 22 invasions of Cyprus in recorded history. And there's one still going on, and there's various other things going on that could be called invasions that don't come into that list of 22. When you hike, when you walk, when you go into the mountains or along the sea and the lower regions, you are walking through history. And if any of you at the end of the session want to know more about Cyprus, I can recommend a really good book of a man who walked up and down the island and used his knowledge of history to explain where he was going as he went. Have any of you been to Cyprus?
Where is Cyprus?
Good question. Cyprus is an island that looks sort of like this in the Mediterranean. It looks sort of like a panhandle or something. And this is Turkey in the eastern Mediterranean, the big country, the Anatolian Peninsula sticking out. Syria is here. Lebanon is here. Israel is here, and Egypt is here. And I've drawn it way out of scale. Cyprus is actually a small island tucked up into this fold, and it's about 40 miles from Turkey. And it's about 70 miles from Syria. And it's about 100 miles from Israel, and maybe 200 miles from Egypt. So it's an island in the far eastern part of the Mediterranean.
From Greece?
Well, it's pretty far, but what do you pick for Greece? The nearest point of Greece is the island of Rhodes here, and it's probably 200-300 miles to Rhodes. And then, of course, there's many, many more islands, but the mainland is probably 700 or 800 miles away. It's a long way from Greece. But as perhaps you're thinking, Cyprus is a Greek island, in majority at least. It has a Turkish minority, and that becomes really an indication of our story throughout history as we look at some of these invasions. The mountain that I mentioned in the title, Mount Olympus, is here, and it's almost 2,000 meters, which makes it 6,600 feet. The top of the island, right there. There are mountains here and here. A chain almost 100 miles long along this feature, and then a central group of mountains there. The scale of this island is also worth noting. I've been coming from the Midwest and telling people that it would fit in Minnesota south of the Twin Cities very easily, with a lot of space left over. But you need that much space to fit in this long arm. It's about 160 miles from there to there. And it's about 50 miles from there to there. So it's not a big place, but it's surprising when you're there just how big it is, because it's very rough country. And the roads have to go a lot of different places to get you anywhere. And it's bigger than it seems. It's a country. It's got about three quarters of a million people in the southern part, the part that's Greek. We live here in Limassol. This is the second biggest city. The capital is up here, Nicosia. And if you sometimes hear news reports from the Middle East, often the man is saying, reporting from Nicosia. Nicosia is kind of a regional center for reporting. Other towns that you might hear about are Paphos, probably the fourth biggest place, and Larnaca, where you land at the airport now. Second biggest town. Enough on that. But when you stand up here on this mountain, as it's not too hard to do, these are rounded mountains, they're not peaks, they're old. You can look down here and you can see the ruins of a classical copper mine from ancient Greek and Roman times, and even pre-Greek times, I think. And the name Cyprus, C-Y-P-R-U-S, is a corruption of the Greek word Kupros. And in fact, the real name of the country is Kupros. In their own language, they refer to it that way. They write it like this. Kupros. And that Kupros means copper. And Cyprus is a corruption of that. So the name of the country is really Kupros. And you can look down on the workings of an ancient mine here, down on the flat from up on top of this mountain. You also look down on the Turkish occupied area, roughly the northern third of the island. You look down on these big bays. There's an ancient city here. You look down on small mountain churches, which have a special story to tell in the history of the island. You'll see some pictures of them in a minute. You look down, especially way off beyond the distant, the nice forested hills on the sea, the Mediterranean. And in winter, and this is the part, that the most fun part of the lecture right this minute. In winter, the top area of these mountains are covered in snow. And it's real heavy-duty snow. It's so wet and so thick, it's not fluffy and easy to get rid of. And the floor of the forest is so nice that you can ski cross-country wild skiing, you know, not in tracks or on a ski slope, but you can ski probably 20 miles by 10 miles on the top of the island on this wonderful Mediterranean snow. And this last year I went skiing for the first time on the 7th of December, and I went skiing for the last time on the 25th of April, which is, those of you who are skiers, that's a pretty good season. We got up to 2 meters of snow on top of the island, and it covered many things up there. The forests up there are huge Mediterranean pines that stand far apart, and you'll see a picture of one later. There's on the top of the island only this rock, very, very metallic rock, and widely spaced trees, and almost no undergrowth. It's a very harsh environment, gets cooked just to beat the band by the sun in the summer, and then in the winter it gets covered in this snow. I still can't quite believe that there's snow an hour from where I live in this end of the Mediterranean, because right now, if you went to Limassol, you would melt in about an hour after you landed. It's about 95 degrees, very, very hot, very, very humid. The only people who enjoy it are the Kuwaitis. They come here for a break. They think it's cooler than Kuwait. But the rest of us try to get out if we can. I think that's enough by way of introduction. The top of the island, this mountain, is covered with a set of houses that have a peculiar look to them. And it turns out that they are British colonial houses. The British governed the island for about 90 years, and in the summer, when the mosquitoes were bad at the end of the last century and through the early decades of this century, the British colonial administrators would take their whole department and move from Nicosia up to the top of the Troodos Mountains. They're called the Troodos Mountains. And so almost the summit of this mountain is covered with this summer village. And one house, the old-timers still say, that's the house of the electricity commission, and that's the house of the public works people, and that's the house of the tax people. And the colonial government would come up with his main civil servants and spend the summer there. Because to stay down on the flat area was to be exposed to too much mosquitoes, too much malaria, and the colonial civil servants were dying too fast. They also brought their soldiers up there to keep them healthy, and so they could keep control of the island. If there's no comments or questions, yeah?
I'm surprised it's so humid over there right now.
Yeah.
I thought that meant it's kind of a dry climate there. I know Israel's kind of dry.
Well, but in winter, you go to Jerusalem in winter and it's damp. Summer is dry in the heights. Jerusalem's fairly high up. It's about 4,000 or 5,000 feet. No, on the coast, this is wet almost all the time. Our winters here, I have never been so cold in my life as winter in Cyprus. 2 weeks after I arrived, I got pneumonia. We don't have central heating in most of the buildings. You sit in your office with all your sweaters that you own on your back. And I didn't do that the first few weeks. I felt fine, because in the sun, it's warm. But you sit inside and you don't realize the way this cold is going through you. And I got sick, real sick, real fast, and since then I wear all my sweaters. There was an ancient Greek writer who said that the Mediterranean is a cold place with a hot sun. And there's something really to that. The minute you get out of the sun in the wintertime, you just shiver. In the sun, you can be fine. You can go in your shirt sleeves in January. There are people who swim in the sea every day. If they're tough, they can do it. But in the shade, indoors, it's a terrible kind of cold. I would much rather be in Minnesota with a dry, real cold, but with central heating. And of course, take away the central heating in Minnesota, we might say that. Let's turn off the lights. And what you'll see is really just a selection of slides that have been taken in the 2 years we've been there. No particular promotion to be made that they're a great introduction to the island of Cyprus. But what I've arranged them now for this session is to give a few indications of the way that all these invasions can be seen when you just live there and go around on the island. The evidence of so many people having been there. We'll start with really prehistory. There's one more switch, I think. Near the door? No. It doesn't really matter. That's okay. This is really prehistory. It is said that the goddess of love was born, Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, was born in Cyprus. And she came out of the sea at this spot. And she came out of the sea. The sea foam gave birth to her. And she became an important figure in the classical period in Cyprus. And there's plenty of evidence that she has been merged with the Virgin Mary as the island became Christian. And there are still people who worship the Virgin Mary with old customs that go back to the Aphrodite cult that used to be the main religion on the island. There's another view of the same spot. In the middle distance is the place where Aphrodite was born. It's called Aphrodite's Rock. Rocks. And actually, I hope I can say this in this company, but the legend has it that those are parts of the Greek god Zeus, that Aphrodite was born from Zeus's testicles, and that those rocks are Zeus's testicles. Part of the coastline of Cyprus. We then go inland up to that mountain that I mentioned. And these are two friends who came from where we used to live in Switzerland to see us, and we took them for a hike up a deserted valley. And you see a stream there that's flowing, and it flows all year. And it's the only stream on the island that I've seen that flows all year. All the other rivers go dry. We're getting up already about halfway into the island. Some snow still there in April. Actually, I think this was, April. And then on the top of the island, you have a small ski station. And all the Cypriots who want to ski have to go and use these three little lifts. This is the best one, actually, the biggest one. It's the size of a small ski place in the Midwest, really. But if you forget the skiing at the station and take your cross-country skis, which nobody seems to do, as far as I know, I've seen one other set of tracks beside my own. It's a wonderful place for cross-country skiing. And up there in the fog, you can't see it, is a British radar installation from which they can listen to the whole eastern Mediterranean.
Is this Mount Olympus?
That's Mount Olympus.
Where was this?
In Cyprus. Pardon?
It says where Zeus was born.
No, she was born. That's the Mount Olympus in Greece.
Okay, that's it.
This place is very Hellenized, and they named their highest mountain Mount Olympus too. Okay.
The other one's Crete, isn't it?
No. Well, Crete's another big island in the Mediterranean. Yeah.
I mean, isn't that where Mount Olympus is? Or
no, it's in mainland Greece.
Mainland Greece,
yeah. This is not about Mount Olympus in Greece, I should say. This is another Mount Olympus. One of those trees that I mentioned to you, at another time of year, you see the metallic, loose covering on the hill, all shattered from frosts and weathering. And then these old trees with its tops busted off. And this winter, with all that snow, a lot more of those tops broke off. But
But they have the air of the sequoias or something in California, and I counted one that was cut down, it had 800 rings. So they go back a ways. Going back towards the lowland, on the left, upper left, you see grapevines. Cyprus has wonderful wine, especially the white wines are very good. The wine culture goes back to the Crusaders, who were here for a long time. And then in the middle distance, another vineyard on that piece of hilltop that's eroding. It's just a bit of soil, and the rest is washing out. And then all the way down to the sea in the distance, and there's actually a town here. It's an amazingly barren and just a real cooked countryside. Right at this time of the year, everything is brown except the olive trees and the carob trees. But in the spring, as this was taken, you can see it's quite green. And despite the apparent barrenness and stoniness and all the prickly things that only grow in hot places, they grow everything from bananas to peaches. They grow everything from any vegetable you want to name, they grow it. And they don't allow import of any fresh produce or fruit. It's all grown on the island. Oh, sorry. This is a shepherd, the man in the stocking cap, telling us where to go as a group hiking. Not too far away, we came upon an old church set in these fields of spring flowers that have actually been introduced in the last 100 years, and they spread everywhere and give it this yellow look. This church is about 300 years old, and you can see the Orthodox, Greek Orthodox look of the church.
The language Greek?
Yeah, the main language is Greek.
So does it rain much in the summer?
It only rains in the winter. It rains from January to March, and then it doesn't rain again. You just saw the church, and that's sort of a common witness all over the place for the fact that Christianity has been in Cyprus for a long time. It came with the Apostle Paul. You can read in Acts how he and Barnabas came to Cyprus. Barnabas was a Cypriot, so since about the year 45 AD, Cyprus has been Christian, with some variations in the way it goes about doing that. The customs are according to the Orthodox tradition, the Greek Orthodox tradition. The Church of Cyprus is a Greek Orthodox autonomous church, and most people belong to it. If you're Cypriot, or Greek Cypriot, I should say, you're Greek Orthodox, basically. And this is Easter Saturday night, one of the highlights of the Easter festival. And Easter is a tremendously large festival in the Orthodox tradition. And what they do is each village church takes the funeral bier of Christ. That's under the flowers there is meant to be the body of Christ, just represented by the flowers. And they parade through the streets, showing everybody this funeral bier. And it's interesting here that there's a soldier assigned to accompany it, and he's carrying his rifle upside down. You have a closeness between church and state, which you see at times like these, where the army is assigned to attend the festivals. This is right near our house, and there's a tourist merry-go-round in the background.
Is that the foreground, that yellow thing?
I think it's a flower or a bush that's just right out of focus. Got the flash. The man in the left with the robe on is my landlord. He sings in the neighborhood church as a chanter. They have elaborate liturgies that go back a long, long way, and he's one of their singers. So on this night, he was in the procession and leading and singing as they walked. Not far from where we live is one of about 700 discos. This is a 007 disco for the tourists. And the church and the priest, you see the priest holding the Bible. That's the local priest. Passed right there down the main road, sort of blessing the tourist industry, I think. My landlord again explaining to me his chanting book. And it's for those of you who are interested in music, they don't use notes like we have. They use a totally different scale. And his chanting is done according to something that looks like shorthand. It's squiggles that go up and down on the page, and he sings according to the squiggle. It's like a, you might invent a way of writing music. And they'll sing, what they're doing is singing the gospel, singing the epistle, singing the Old Testament, and singing all the various canticles and introits and all those things that we're used to in our liturgy, those of us who are Lutherans. There are elaborate festivals for different times of the year and customs, especially relating to baking. And here they're doing something called falaunas. This is our landlord's daughter, two daughters. And they're making these cheese pies. It's sort of a cheese pasty. And it's the food with which they break the Lenten fast. At the start of Lent, they have a big feast day where everybody goes out in the country and eats only greens, and it's called Green Monday. And you feel like a rabbit. They put in front of you a table piled with fresh greens. It's spring, everything's green, and it's normally barren island. You gorge yourself on raw greens, and that's the start of a vegetarian meal and diet for the next 40 days, or how long Lent is. They don't eat dairy products or meat in that whole time. Then they break the fast with this dairy-based cheese pasty called falaunas. And here they're making the falaunas. They make dozens and dozens of them. I have 150 of them and give them to all their neighbors. And each house has a stove, an oven like this in the backyard that usually the householder has made himself. There's the landlord stoking the fire, sticking the falaunas in there, and his wife in the foreground. Gonna slip a few baked potatoes in there and a tinfoil too in it. Unfortunately, this Easter they didn't get done. They got done too well. They came out pretty black, and there was just a calamity downstairs because they had ruined about half of the falaunas, and they didn't have enough to give away. Another invasion in the history of Cyprus was the Romans. They came in about 50 years before Christ, and they stayed off and on for 600 years, really. The island benefited from Roman influence and Roman peace, or control, whatever you like. These are the mosaics on the floors of Roman villas discovered in the town of Paphos. They're villas that were built in the 2nd and 3rd century, and a farmer was plowing his fields in the mid-60s, and he noticed some colored tiles in his dirt. He stopped plowing, and they got the antiquities people in and started to clear away the dirt. And they found the floors of these villas. This is one little tiny section, but you see the richness of it. Imagine having a house where somebody had built your floor that way out of little tiny pieces the size of, smaller than postage stamps, with all the different colors. And it doesn't show very well here, but some of them still have very bright oranges and blues. And the houses that these come from are the size of Koinonia building, or this building, or the next building. Enormous villas. They're left there. They built a roof over them, and you can go and walk around and see five or six of these villas, which were in a rich suburb of Paphos 1,800 years ago. After the Peace of Rome broke down from about the 7th to the 10th century, the island was subjected to wave after wave of pirates and colonizers that didn't last very long. And a lot of those 22 invasions, I think, happened in this period from the 7th to the 10th century, of invasions that went along with the spread of Islam and the spread of the Arabic-speaking peoples throughout the region. The people of Cyprus, the Greek, the Hellenized Cypriots, retreated to the inland and built villages in the inland. What you see there is certainly not from that period. There's not very much old things on Cyprus as such where people live in, but it's an example of a present-day mountain village, and you see how rugged the terrain is. Looks like the Cascades. No? Not quite. Another one, village of Talaki. Not too far from where we live, about half an hour's drive. Again, fairly early in the year, a little greener than it would look right now. But the mountain forests stay that greenish blue. They're mostly conifers. A village house and the typical sort of courtyard. you see the collection of building materials, modern bricks and tin roof and old stone wall. The church in that village. A church nearby which has on it a sloped roof to which dates back to about 1,000 years, to the time when there was more snow apparently, and they had to protect those domed roofs that you saw in the earlier church in the yellow field. They don't do very well under the snow. They collapse or they leak. So they put wooden roofs over the top of those domes on some of the older churches that have survived in the inlands. Another of these churches. And inside are frescoes, Byzantine frescoes from the period after the Arab raiders were kicked out and the Byzantines reasserted their rule around about the year 1000. They painted the walls of the churches with Bible stories. And it's for a non-literate public, it's the mass media of the day. And you can sit in church, these little churches, and look at the wall and just recount every major story in the Bible and some of the ones which have happened since as well. And they're in remarkable color. They're really world-class art treasures, the Byzantine frescoes from the 11th and 12th century in these Cyprus mountain churches. They don't allow you to photograph them, but I'll pass around a book later which has some of them in it.
Have they had the eyes scratched
out by the Islamic, or did... No, the Muslims never got up into the mountains. In some cases they did, but and they did that to the, they did some defacing and so on to churches in the lowlands along the coast. And it's still going on in the Turkish-occupied sector because Islam doesn't believe in images that relate to God. You know, God can't be pictured, so it's especially offensive to them to come across all these paintings of God and his mother and his wife and, you know, his daughter and sons and all these.
Why didn't they go up to the mountains?
Well, it's pretty tough going. Not a lot, you know, why would you go to the mountains to raid a poor village? I think Cyprus wasn't that prosperous in that period. I think the prosperity of antiquity had gone. This is a shot in the Turkish-occupied northern part of the island, and those mountains in the distance are those long chain, 100-mile-long chain, and we're standing on that chain that goes along the top of the island. This castle is one of the neatest castles that I've ever seen. It's called St. Hilarion, and it dates to the Crusader kingdoms, which there was a Crusader dynasty that established itself when the Western Christian, in quotes, knights came to try to take back the Holy Lands. They quickly took Cyprus sort of as an afterthought and held sway there for 300 years. And so you had an imported ruling class who were Latin. They were from the Western Church, not the Eastern Church. They spoke French, they didn't speak Greek, and they were French instead of Greek ethnically. And they built castles along the tops of these mountains to protect the place. And this particular castle sits among rock buttresses, using the rock as part of its fortifications, in a terribly romantic site, if you want to get excited about castles, overlooking the north coast of Cyprus. That's the view from one of the buttresses. And down there is the port of Kyrenia, which is a city on the northern side, occupied since 1974 by the Turks. And the city from which some of us would know the story of Exodus, where that one ship sat in the harbor for several days or weeks, while the Jewish people tried to get freedom from the British to go back to Israel in 1948, in the book Exodus, the movie Exodus, where Paul Newman was on board. Well, that was in the harbor of Kyrenia. You'll see a picture of it in a minute, in Cyprus. They did the staging for the Exodus from Cyprus. One of the buildings that's still standing, looking out over those mountains again. For 300 years, these people came up here every summer. It was sort of their olden village. They spent their summers out away from the hot coast, and it had a beautiful climate. It's about 4,000 feet up. Another view. Thousand-year-old castle, almost 900 years. That's Kyrenia Harbor, and the ship Exodus sat right there between the small boats. you can see several things of interest. On the far right is a steeple of a Greek Orthodox church, which is now being turned into a museum. On the left is a mosque, minaret tower. Just on the far left is the walls of what are a great big fortress built by the Venetians in the 15th or 16th century. And the castle you were just looking at is up there on that, on those mountains, right on the top of those mountains. A very pretty harbor. And this was a Greek Cypriot town until the invasion of 1974. Long to go back to this place. You see bumper stickers, "I love Kyrenia," all over the island. Another part of the island, the Greek side again, with vineyards for wine, and a mosque that's sitting boarded up for 22 years since the invasion. But this village had been Turkish. The Turkish minority, about 20% of the population, were not in one place. They were sprinkled around. And so when the Turkish army from the mainland invaded to protect them in 1974, it had to gather them in from largely the south, where they lived dispersed among the Greek population. Please interrupt if you've got questions.
Can you go back and forth between the two parts of Cyprus?
As a tourist, you can, but you've got to be back. You can only go from the south to the north, and you've got to come back by 6 o'clock at night. They don't want you to spend any money over there. They don't want you to stay overnight. They don't want you to go, really, because it's recognizing the other side. From the north, you can't come to the south. Nobody can.
North is the
Turkish.
North is the Turkish.
North is Turkish and south is Greek.
Okay.
The south is independent. The north is independent in the eyes of Turkey, but nobody else in the world recognizes it. It's called the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. Nobody recognizes it. It's
your passports, your border guards.
Yeah, there's a line of, it's like the Berlin Wall. Yeah. The capital Nicosia is divided in two, and streets end in barricades. And you can see a Greek army or a Greek Cypriot army post, and you can see, and their flag. Then you can see about 30, 40 yards away, depending on how wide the wall is at that point, or the no man's land, a UN flag, blue UN flag and some blue helmets. They're Swedish and Finnish UN soldiers. And then further you can see the Turkish, up there on the minaret, the right-hand flag is the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, the left-hand flag is the Turkish flag. Cyprus is the only island in the world where you regularly see two flags. In the north you see the Turkish flag and the Turkish Cypriot flag. In the south you see the Greek flag and the Greek Cypriot flag. And you sometimes sort of can kid your Greek Cypriot friends about why the Turks would have invaded, thinking that perhaps they were going to lose the island completely and it would join Greece. That was the movement from the right wing of the Cypriot population, was to join Greece. And everywhere you look, there's Greek flags flying. So there's something to the argument that this place was in danger. The slide here shows, if you notice the window, have you seen a window like that before? Notice the buttresses. This is a Gothic cathedral built under the influence of the Crusader Christian rulers of Cyprus, turned into a mosque. Just chop off the spires and put minarets on. Go inside, take out all the decorations. Inside it's completely white. Take out all the decorations, keep the nice windows, they're okay. And you've got a mosque. Another view. See the church? See the Gothic windows? And then it's got the mosque on top. Also in the north, you can see here, this is at July, August, you can see how dry the countryside is now. This is how it all looks now. And it doesn't show very well, but this is not too far from the Greek line in Nicosia, and all of Nicosia can see these mountains. And right here, you have the half moon, or the crescent moon of the Turkish flag with the star there, and some words in Turkish. And then next to it, you have the Turkish Cypriot flag laid out in white stones, the size of 10 football fields, so that the Greeks will always remember who's holding the other part of their island. This is neither Turkish nor Greek, it's British. When the British gave up their control of the island, they made an agreement that three areas be forever theirs. They're called sovereign base areas. And they have their largest airfield outside of Britain. They have a permanent military presence there on these three bases, and once a year, their aerobatic team, the Red Arrows, comes and trains, because Cyprus has very, very stable weather, namely sunny, about, you know, 9/10 of the year. And these guys train here every spring before going back to Britain for the summer air show season. And before they leave, they do free air shows for the three major cities. So this is taken on the waterfront. There's my wife Marion and Lonnie and Michael and some friends watching from the waterfront. You get a free air show, and in return the British get to keep part of the island. While we're on the subject of the British, this is our neighbor, a woman named Josie. She's British, who married a Cypriot. Many Cypriot men go overseas for university because they're just establishing a university on the island. And while they're overseas, I think they're sort of dark, handsome Mediterranean types, they tend to come home with women, married. And there are quite a few British and American wives, much more British than American, but Josie is one of those who came, and she spent most of her time windsurfing. Another form of presence on the island, not exactly an invasion, but the woman on the right is a Lebanese, a Maronite Christian from Lebanon. The minority who used to control Lebanon and did all right while they were in control, but have lost control now to the Muslim majority. And many of them have left for different places, many of them in the US and Canada and Australia, but some are in Cyprus, and she's a neighbor of ours. We were out with her family. There's her husband under the big olive tree, having a picnic.
She doesn't even look Mediterranean, huh?
Well, yeah, when you talk about Lebanon or even the Palestinians, the Crusaders have left their mark. You can see blonde Palestinians, and it's because of the Crusaders. And Lebanon has had links to the West since the Crusades. They had a big Crusader kingdom there too. And the Maronites claim they've been in touch with Rome since the 12th century. They always look to Rome. They're Eastern Catholics in a way, but they always look west. Some spring flowers that lured us to have a picnic there. Another comment about nationalities. What you get in Cyprus here, as you might be sort of hearing, is that you get examples of all the peoples of the Mediterranean and a few others as well. There aren't many Americans, so we're sort of an odd lot to be there. The woman on the left is an Armenian. And as you may know, Armenia has had a very tough history. It's had very little of its own control through the millennia. But they spread throughout the world. They just had a big hand in opening the Mall of America in Minneapolis. And there's an Armenian community in Nicosia, about 1,500 people. And the woman on the left is a woman I work with. And she's from that Armenian Cypriot community. And they still call themselves Armenians, even though they've been in Cyprus for 100, 200 years. The woman on the right is from Malawi, and her husband is with the UN in Iraq, and she doesn't want to live there with her children, so she's bringing her children to Cyprus for school. That's our house, just by the way, in the background. And if you look on the roof of the house, you see metal bars sticking up. Those metal bars are for the day when they're going to add another story to the house. They're always ready to build more and to rent it out to tourists.
Right or left is your house?
Excuse me?
Your house on the right or the left?
Left. A castle left over from the Crusaders and another port. The beach in Limassol. Limassol is benefiting from the sea and the sun. And the spring flowers help too, but it has a real tourist invasion. It's not listed in the 22 invasions, but ever since the invasion of the Turks, the south has gone ahead in a big way with tourism. And we have a lot of British retired people living on the island. It used to be part of the British Empire, so they feel happy there. And then package tours coming from England. You can come to Cyprus for £100 round trip, and then another £100 to buy your room and board for the week. And you're guaranteed sun and sand and sea And even if the place is getting pretty junky and the building styles aren't very nice, you still have a good vacation, apparently. Tourist hotel in the background, the same merry-go-round and an old bridge. An example of the unique zoning laws that they have, you can have one-story buildings right next to eight-story buildings. And they say there's a law against it, but nobody's seen any effect from that law yet. Nice tree. Our landlord, he's actually a bulldozer driver, but every Sunday he looks like this. And he's profiting from the tourist influx too, because he's built his house and he rents it out. The office of the Middle East Council of Churches, where I work, is the upstairs of this house here. And then my office is upstairs in the next house. And behind us is some more of these big buildings breathing down your neck. Out in the country, and I think I took the picture because you have the tourist invasion and the nationalist situation right there in the flags. British on the left, Greek next, then Cypriot, and then German. Between the British and the German and the Swedes and the Finns, they have, I think, over a million or 2 million tourists a year, 1.7 million tourists a year. There are attractions in the mountains, villages like this that have been partly restored, and very pleasant climate. Quaint streets. See some of the living rock built into the wall on the right there. Two ladies having a talk. The older ladies are still seen in that black dress, which is throughout the Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Very modest form of dress, which is something akin, I think, sociologically to what Muslim women are forced to wear. Some donkeys still, but by and large, pickup trucks have replaced donkeys in a big way, and Japan is happy. The roof of a Greek Orthodox church, sort of a unique Cypriot style, the same church.
Will you explain a little bit more about the political situation?
Yeah, the slides are about done. A mountain village, and that bright object on top of the hill is a mountain church. And good night. If we turn on the lights again, I'd like to talk a little more about that political situation at present. And if you've got questions, we have 15 minutes.
Does anybody know the trick?
Two
person? Could you help me? Thanks. Now, as you've seen, evidence of invasions, and I won't list them all, but let me just read to you the invasions that are the major ones. First of all, there were Neolithic people there, and there's still settlements that go back to 10,000 years, round rock houses on the sides of the hillside, and you think, you know, who lived here and what were they like? Then the Achaeans, who are the people from this one part of the Peloponnesus in Greece, the people from which we get Homer and the classical legends of ancient Greece. The Achaeans came, and they Hellenized the island. They made the island Greek in about 2000 BC. And it's very interesting that a little bit of a dialect, Cyprus Greek is different from Greek Greek, but not too different. They can easily understand each other. But there are words here that go back and are found in the Odyssey in Homer. There are words used in everyday life in this part of the island that go back to the Odyssey as an example of that link to an invasion 4,000 years ago, and much not found on mainland Greece at all. After the Achaeans, we had the Assyrians. I think Nebuchadnezzar and those guys, they were Assyrians. Some of their armies came over and took the island for a while. Then, after them came the Egyptians, back in about the year 1000. After them, we've got the Persians, the ones that Alexander the Great beat. But before he beat them, they were pretty big throughout the Mediterranean. Then Alexander the Great took over. I don't know, how much history buffs are you? Should I continue with this list? The Romans, about 60 years before Christ's birth, included it in the Roman Empire, and they gave it back and forth. I think Mark Antony gave it to Cleopatra at one point. He said, here, you can have this island. The year 45, you could call it an invasion, not exactly, but the Christian invasion. Paul and Barnabas landing here at Paphos. There's still a church there where it is claimed that Paul was whipped. There's a pillar against which he was whipped, according to local tradition. You won't find it in the Bible. But typical of the Middle East, there's all kinds of stories that are not in the Bible, which are the basis of local legend. And if you trace it back, it goes back a long, long way, and it's not something to be just thrown out. After that, you had, I think, the Arabic invasions along the coast where all the people went inland. Then you had the Byzantines reasserting their control. And in the year 1000, Christianity split. 1054, Christianity split. And Cyprus was part of the eastern branch of Christianity from then on. And then you had a confusion in these invasions of eastern and western Christianity. After the Byzantines, for a while, the Crusaders came. And it's Richard the Lionheart was on his way to the Crusades, and he'd arranged with the King of Sicily to marry her daughter here at Limassol. She got there before him on her ship. The local Byzantine lord didn't treat her very well, tried to marry her himself, and wanted to make some money out of her. Richard the Lionheart, on the third or the fourth Crusade, whichever one it was, landed, whipped the local Byzantine ruler, got his queen back, married her, never saw her again, sailed off to the Holy Land and started doing the Crusades there. But from that time on, Cyprus was a Crusader kingdom for about 300 years, and he gave it to a family from France called the Lusignan family, and they're the people who built that nice castle up on the mountain ridge. After the Crusaders, the Venetians held it as a business proposition and taxed the place dry for 100 years in about the year 1500. And the Cypriot people through all this are not getting a real good deal, you know. They're being ruled from outside all the time. And it's got to be part of their mentality today as you think what's happening to them today. After the Venetians, you had 300 years of Ottoman Turkish rule. And to say a word on behalf of the Turks, their memory tells them, this has been part of us since 1671. So what's all the squawk about us occupying and protecting our minority again now? Because they held it, the Ottoman Empire controlled it until the British bartered it away from them in 1878. The British held it for about 80 years, and it was under their rule that the movement of independence came after World War II, when many countries were getting independence and empires, the empires of the Western powers were no longer viable. So they had to decide what to do about Cyprus. They wanted to keep it because it's a great spot, and that's why it's been invaded so many times. It's sitting astride the communications lines of the Middle East. If you're going to the Suez Canal and to the Far East, you pass right by. If you are talking about the power of Turkey or the this much prized area of the world or Greece, it's interesting to you. The British tried to hang on for a long time. They felt they had an obligation to hang on as part of their agreement with Turkey. They started using the Turkish minority, about 20% of the population, a little more, is Turkish. Going back to those 300 years of Turkish rule, Turkish and Muslim, 20%. The other 80% is Greek. That is Greek culture, Greek language, but they're all Cypriots, but Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots. And the Turkish Cypriots lived, that mosque I showed you in the village by the vineyards is right here. They lived around here. You can go in the countryside and find empty villages. They're Turkish Cypriot villages that are now empty. So it wasn't as if Turkey could come in and just protect them very easily. It was like protecting some fish in a net and letting others go. The British had this connection to Turkey, and they used the Turkish minority to keep the Greek majority down. They incited the Turkish minority against the Greek majority. The Greek majority started being tough on the Greek, Turkish minority. They started putting embargoes around their villages, not allowing trade, enclaving them, raiding them sometimes. There was intercommunal killings. This is in the 50s. Finally, in 1960, Britain was forced to give independence to the country, and they set up a constitution which had a Greek president and a Turkish vice president. Guaranteed. You had to have a Greek president and a Turkish vice president. That worked for a little while, but by 64, and some of you remember now in your living memory of the newscast, you've heard that in 64, in the 60s already, Cyprus was a trouble spot. And it made our kind of news, which is oriented towards trouble spots. And they had to send in a UN force. And of all these UN peacekeeping forces you're hearing about around the world, one of the oldest ones is right here, sitting along the Green Line, and it's called UNFISIP, UN Force in Cyprus. And it's one of the oldest ones, and they're getting a little tired of paying for it because the two sides haven't settled their differences after all these years. It's been there since 1964, going on 30 years. The country went for 14 years as a mixed community, an independent mixed community. But they had a unique situation that the head of the Church of Cyprus and church and state come very close together, especially at the high altitude level and at the low level too in the villages. The head of the Church of Cyprus, Archbishop Makarios, was also president of the country. So it would be like, you know, if we were all Lutherans here and Chilstrom was our bishop as well as being president of the United States, but in a much more intense way, because religion is right through the life, and they haven't done a Western thing of separating church and state and of separating really religion from everyday life the way we sometimes tend to. It's all mixed up together. The festivals run through the week. My landlord goes and chants every morning at 6 o'clock in that church, a liturgy. So the religion is all part of the life, especially in the villages. And Makarios, as a Greek, was both president and archbishop at the same time. And he tried to balance things out, but his sentiments were clearly towards the Greek majority, and he wanted to assure as good a place as possible for them. He was balancing things, but the Greek military junta in the early 70s got a little more carried away than him, and in the end they instigated a coup against him to put in more right-wing people so that the whole island could go and become part of Greece, just be a Greek province. When that happened, when Makarios was toppled, the Turks took it as a pretext and they invaded. They had massed their armies here on this coast. They flew over, dropped paratroopers, and the summer of 1974 was a dramatic time, and many people in Cyprus have a lot of stories to tell about what happened. But the Turks took first Kyrenia and a couple of the towns. Then they pushed forward, and if you look at the map, there are about four lines, and they get worse and worse as the Greeks and the Turkish sides negotiated and said, stop, don't take any more, let's make peace. The peace talks broke down, the Turks pushed further. They took part of the capital real from Kyrenia very early in the peace. And they ended up with a line that runs something like this. And at one point there's an incredible peninsula that comes out and takes a Turkish village which they came within range of, and then goes back up. And you have one of the craziest borders in the world. And it's there still. The ceasefire line is the border. And it's like the line between East and West Germany used to be. But it's not German. You know, it doesn't have miles and miles of minefields and automatic shooting devices, and it's pretty tame stuff, but you're not able to get anywhere near it. You'll get warned off by all three sides, the Turks, the UN, and the Greek side. Yes?
Are they still mixing the different cultures between the two sides, or are they really polarized?
It's totally separate. It polarized in the Troubles. Yeah. Since the Second World War, it began to polarize, and what you had was sort of apartheid developing, that Turkish enclaves in a Greek majority. What happened with the invasion was Turkey came in and said, come to us. And 200,000 Greeks were forced out of the north. Really, one Greek in four was pushed south and became a refugee, a displaced person in their own country. And something like 150,000 Turkish inhabitants of isolated places, mostly in this section of the island, had to leave and go to the north.
Were there violence when that happened, or was it sort of peaceful?
That was peaceful. The population exchange was peaceful. They didn't have to fight their way up there. One of the quirks of this whole business is that we were out walking one day, and we came to one of these lines where we didn't know they were any. And there's a little spot, actually the border goes like this. There's a little spot here, no, here, yeah, right, there. Little tiny bite out of the coast. And it was another Turkish village that they took. But it's so isolated now, there's no people living in it anymore, only the Turkish army. But there's a little bite there. Then there's an island of Greeks here. This is called the Karpas Peninsula. And way out here, this is a very remote peninsula, hard to get to, very rugged. There's an enclave of about 500 Greek Cypriots who are still there. They refuse to leave. They're getting older and older. They have a priest. They have a school teacher. Their kids come out for school and can't go back very often. They can come out to shop, but they have to stay out a week if they come, and they can only come with a permit that they have to apply with long advance. Both sides are mucking around with it. But you have an enclave of Greeks here who are still holding out as an example of the previous population.
Did I hear you right that the British encouraged the...
In the pre-independence time, they had a small guerrilla movement from the Greek nationalists, the ones who wanted union with Greece. And to counter that, they said to the Turkish minority, you know, stand up for your rights. Don't let these Greeks get too carried away here. Their own interest was to keep the place divided and maintain it as their own possession in the region.
So they didn't want the two sides to get together?
No, they didn't encourage a bi-communal solution, which is the point of the negotiations now. This was 1974, and they've been negotiating ever since, almost. But at one point they broke down, and Turkey declared this part a republic, and it's called the TRNC, Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. And as I said, the only country who recognizes this country is Turkey. But you can go to either side. If you want to go to the north, you can't come from the south and stay. You can fly into the north. You can go to your travel agent. It's just an interesting exercise. Not many Americans go there, but if you're in Europe, you can go to your travel agent and say, I want to go to northern Cyprus. And they'll give you a brochure which advertises it as a totally separate place. And you can't go to the south. When I went to the north with my sister, it was like two worlds. It was like it used to be crossing the Iron Curtain. The other side has 30,000 Turkish troops. There's military everywhere. It has 30 or 40,000 Turkish settlers who have been given the land of those Greek refugees. And some of them have now been there long enough to have kids. So their kids feel like it's their place. And you have a deepening and a separation, which is going to be harder and harder to bridge. And of the five people I talked to in that short visit of a day, four out of the five were immigrants from mainland Turkey. They weren't Turkish Cypriots. And the one Turkish Cypriot that I met was a taxi driver. And I said to him, will there be a solution? And he said, no, not until everybody who was living at that time is dead. Because we know who killed our relatives. There were some reprisal killings back and forth. We know who killed them. And if they let the border go away, we're going to go over and even the score. I don't think it's perhaps, I mean, that might happen in some cases, but other people have a more optimistic view. As you cross, there's a checkpoint in Nicosia called the Ledra Palace crossing. It's just like Checkpoint Charlie. And as you walk over, the Greek Cypriots have a whole bunch of signs saying, don't go visit the people who murdered all of our people and still have 1,700 missing people, missing persons. And, you know, it's an apartheid state, don't go there, don't give them the dignity of your presence. Well, you go anyway, carefully, I mean, it's not the greatest thing to do. And you pass over, and the Turks are very friendly, they welcome you, and then they have their signs showing how the Greeks murdered their babies, and you have to walk a gauntlet of propaganda posters on both sides of the border. But once you're beyond that, it's normal people, of course, on both sides.
So you can't spend money on it?
Well, you can, but they don't want you to spend any more than you have to, so they don't let you spend the night. They don't want to promote any kind of tourism inadvertently. they can't stop you going over, you know. Just two other quick points that I wanted to mention was, I mentioned the Middle East Council of Churches, which is really a representative of the Eastern churches, the Middle Eastern churches, headquartered now on the island, because they used to be in Beirut over here, but it got too hot to do business, and the telephone lines don't work, and all these other, electricity is on only when you have your own generator, and all the other problems in Beirut in recent years. So they moved here to Limassol. There's also a heavy presence on the island of Western Christians, fundamentalists and evangelicals, and some who are both. And they see the island as a strategic spot from which to penetrate the Muslim world. And a lot of it is oriented towards a media, a long-distance invasion, where somehow we can pour our gospel into the airwaves and beam it to people without getting our hands dirty or without really dealing with them as human beings, and save them with this gospel. And as a communications person, working in Christian communications, Christian media for a long time, that's something I have a little trouble with myself, and that's something that the local Christians have trouble with, because they would like to see this gospel represented in a way that is compatible with the societies that are there, and that means compatible with the Muslim majority. So it's an interesting invasion that you can't see. This presence of Western missionaries who are using Cyprus as a base from which to deal with clandestine and tent maker and media ministries in the Arab world. And there's some good work going on. I'm not trying to criticize the whole thing. But the mentality of some of them, especially Pat Robertson's group, CBN, they are here. Their headquarters, they give this as an address.